KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I've asked the military services and the other components to immediately begin implementing prudent measures that will help mitigate our budget risks.
The thing about Asian food that always bugs Westerners out, savory foods with a gelatinous texture. This is probably like the boogeyman food to an American or Western palate.
Samsung wants me to be in their new, their big commercial. Next big thing, yeah.
They called me in for the next big thing.
Maybe in 1998.
Ooh, Burn, Paul Rudd, by Seth Rogen. We're going to be talking about Super Bowls, advertising, and the common denominator next hour. You also heard from Eddie Huang. We're going to be talking with him. He's a restaurateur, a fashion designer, and much more. He's written a book called Fresh Off the Boat. But we start with the question of sequestration. You heard Leon Panetta talking about the issues he's taking up and the plans he's making if sequestration goes through. Just about an hour from now, President Obama, as you heard in the news, is going to ask Congress to pass some spending cuts, some tax reforms to avoid the sequester, which is an across-the-board $1.2 trillion cut to defense and domestic spending set to take effect March 1st. Republican House Speaker John Boehner has hinted he's not so eager to strike a deal just yet. Boehner says the president's sequester should be replaced with spending cuts and reforms that will start us on the path to balancing the budget in 10 years. Doesn't sound like they're that far apart, but they seem to be. Steve Bell is Senior Director for Economic Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He's been looking at the sequestration and the sequester. Steve Bell, thanks for talking to us.
Glad to be on.
You know, just to be sure we're all on the same page once again, what is the sequester's sequester designed to do?
It was designed to scare people in the policymaking arena, in the White House and in Congress, so much by its really kind of unpalatable kind of across-the-board cuts that they would take action for an alternative, which wouldn't be so ham-handed. In other words, it was never supposed to be implemented. We first did it in 1986, and then President Reagan even said in his message to Congress, this isn't the way we ought to cut budgets. So it was designed to scare people into doing what they ought to do.
Why is it that it's ham-handed? It takes 10% out of all the budgets. Why in a few months couldn't the people who run those budgets start to move other money around to put it in the proper silo?
Well, for two reasons. One, that would be illegal under current law. You cannot spend money for a purpose other than for which it was appropriated. And number two, and connected to that, is these across-the-board cuts are going to hit every program, project, and activity of the federal government in those areas of defense and non-defense that you discussed. They're going to hit them equally, which means you're going to take, let's say, 8% off of national defense program that nobody wants and they want to get rid of, and 8% off of a program that is growing and important. So you have no flexibility to throw out the bad and retain the good in these kinds of cuts across the board.
All right. Now, you have worked on Capitol Hill for a long time. You were a Senate Budget Committee member when Republicans were in charge. So you've looked at these budgets, try to understand the politics behind them. What impact do you think the cut on defense spending would have on the economy?
Our estimate right now is that the defense cut alone, probably over this year, the rest of this year, and part of next, will cost approximately 1 million private sector jobs. We are conservative in that estimate. I know that CBO, Congressional Budget Office, has said 1.4 million, and there are others using numbers as high as 3 million. Frankly, the most important impact will be on the average working man and woman. It will not be on the government employee, although it will make that person uncomfortable. But it's going to be on the contractors and subcontractors who do work every day, regardless of where it is. It could be in Seattle or it could be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I'm from. But every day people cut the lawn and fix roofs for federal buildings, and all of that is contracting. It's not just defense weaponry. all of that will be cut. And it'll have those cuts are just over the next 7 months.
But we've already seen cuts in government spending, and we've seen what impact it's had on the economy. Why is this more alarming than the cuts we've seen in government, state, local, and federal over the last couple of years?
These cuts are going to trickle down into the states and into the localities. In fact, probably already have started to do so. In part, the poor economic results that we got last quarter were in part due to the fact that people are planning for the sequester. I think when you are told by the Secretary of Defense, and you're also told by the Office of Management and Budget, as an agency director, that you should prepare for furloughing your employees 1 day a week, and that would be 1 day a week without pay, that it is very much more significant than anything we've seen so far. This is going to be a larger cut, and it's going to be a cut right in the middle of the sweet spot that we hope to recreate here, and that's manufacturing.
But don't the sequester hawks, if I may call them that, don't they want to see the government contract at least this level or even higher? Wouldn't those same cuts, if they were to go through, have similar impact on the economy?
Oh, yes. If people who wanted very large deficit reduction right now had their way, there's no doubt in our minds, and I think the minds of most economists, that we would see a dropping back off into a recession in the United States. I don't think there's much argument about that. The question is, how do you get growth started in the short run? Because none of this will work without new economic growth.
Isn't there some argument in that from the from John Boehner and the Republicans who are pushing for deeper cuts or going off the sequester?
Yes, and quite frankly, we have come out very strongly here against the sequester, and we have in fact proposed a program that phases in changes in spending over the long term, 5, 10, 15 years. You make the changes now in Medicare, in Medicaid, in the pension programs, but you phase it in. Present beneficiaries would not be affected. That is an intelligent way, and it's a way that most people are pushing for in this town that are not elected officials. The problem is this. If you tell a member of Congress or the Senate, take an action now that will make Medicare beneficiaries confused or mad, and the benefit won't really start showing up until 10 years from now, that senator or congressman is going to say to you, you mean I'm going to get the blame and not for any gain? And it's a human nature situation where people want, if they're going to take pain, they want immediate gratification. And those folks in Congress are no different than the rest of us. So it's very difficult to get them to say, okay, I'm going to pass something now, and the good stuff will happen when I'm out of office.
Steve Bell is a senior director for economic policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He served for many years working on budgets when the Republicans held the Senate. You said, I think we're going to have the cuts for some period of time, and I think the squeals from constituents will compel some compromise that will emerge in the second half of March. The momentum has shifted to those in the GOP who believe that the only savings we're going to get are going to be the sequester savings. Are those the same GOP people you were working with when you were in Congress?
No, sadly. I was very lucky. When I worked in Congress, when I worked as staff director of the United States Senate Budget Committee, the chairman was a man named Pete Domenici from New Mexico, and the majority leader was Howard Baker, and the minority leader was George Mitchell and Robert C. Byrd later. And those people could make deals. They would look at each other and say, my caucus can't support the following three things. And they would take those things off the table. And the 80% that was left, they would make a deal on. We made a deal with President Reagan with his first budget. We made a deal he didn't like in 1985. And we made a deal in 1996-97 with then-President Clinton. The difference is in the intractable polarization of the parties. There's lots of reasons for it. Gerrymandering of districts, challenges in primaries to someone who doesn't follow the party line appropriately, whether it's left or right. And so things have gotten much more polarized. People who used to be able to make a deal no longer serve in the Senate and the House. And in fact, in both parties, if you try to make some sort of bipartisan deal, you may assure yourself of a primary challenge, either from the far left, if you're a Democrat, or the far right, if you're a Republican. So things are much different. We never thought the sequester was a good idea, even though it was under our jurisdiction that we first came up with a sequester idea to force spending cuts. And as I said, when President Reagan sent the message in FY86 on sequester up to the Congress, he even said, this is not the way to do business. We only did it once, and we haven't done it again.
Just real quickly, is it really fair to say the Democrats are as intransigent as the Republicans on this issue?
Oh, sure. Yeah. If you mention Medicare changes or you mention Medicaid changes or changes to pension plans, they just look at you and say no. If you mention new taxes or new revenues to Republicans, they just look at you and say no.
So President Obama's going to make this statement at 1:15. He's going to call on ways to sort of put off the sequester. Do you see anything in that proposal that looks promising?
The fact that he's doing it is promising. I hope that the ideas which are floating around on Capitol Hill for avoiding the sequester kind of marry up to his ideas and that we can get some sort of deal, because we really do not want, given our economy's situation, a sequester.
What ideas do you think would be the best to emerge from this?
I think there are new revenues that can be gained by closing loopholes in the tax code. The president himself mentioned things that Wall Street folks use called carried interest. There are other important loopholes that could be closed, which advantage certain industries or certain kinds of behavior. And on the spending side, you need to just bite the bullet and say, we have to phase in changes to Medicare and Medicaid. If we don't, we're not going to get this under control.
Do that now, you think the president should propose?
Implement it, pass it now, but the law would phase it in over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, then it sounds like holding the sequester sword over people's head has had the effect the people who want to change Medicare and Medicaid have hoped for.
One, we will see how it... Since I'm a budget person, I'm normally pessimistic. Because that's what the last 40 years have taught me. But I do have some hope that they'll be able to put together a package and avoid the sequester. I think we're going to have a couple of weeks of a sequester or a couple of days. I think it'll take that. But I hope we can get a deal.
What impact would the sequester have on defense employment in an area like Puget Sound, where so much of the economies of some of the southern counties are dependent upon Joint Base Lewis McChord on the Bangor Naval Station?
Well, the Navy has put out recently its assessment. I think it's fair to say that if we had the full sequester for the rest of this fiscal year, the remaining 7 months, right now it would be about a 30% cut in the present spending rate of the Department of Defense. That's because they have spent a great deal of their money in advance. They have done it to prepare for the sequester, and I think that the Defense Department, especially with Panetta's warning for furloughs, and with the fact that we've already seen negotiations and are seeing negotiations between the big defense contractors and the Pentagon on penalties for canceling or delaying contracts, will tell you that the impact would be quite substantial. Major contractors are able to absorb this kind of blow much easier than people who are subcontractors. The people who work in Tacoma, the people who work in other institutions, whether it's Hanford or wherever it is, those people are going to feel it as subcontractors much more acutely because they are smaller, they have less flexibility, they have less of a buffer, and when they delay, they have to delay paying their employees, and that has an immediate impact on the area. So it's this trickle-down effect or domino effect that really is the worst part and least understood of the sequester idea.
All right, Mr. Bell, I appreciate you explaining it to us.
Thank you very much for the time. But I should tell you, I was born in Walla Walla, Washington.
Yeah.
And love the state.
Oh, I thought you could tell me, and as somebody from there, you remain skeptical of...
Oh, no. My mother went to Whitman, and we're big fans.
Well, I appreciate that. You should come. I hope you come back and, you know, see the whole homestead sometimes.
We'll do it.
All right. Steve Bell is Senior Director for Economic Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center, talking about the sequester, its impacts. President Obama is going to, in about an hour, is going to call on Congress to pass a package of spending cuts and tax changes to delay the deep reductions in domestic and defense spending that would start next month. And as you heard, the deep and profound impact federal government spending has on even the people who mow lawns. This is Weekday.
Eddie Wong has been a lawyer and a stand-up comedian. Now he's a writer and a TV star, and he'll be our guest in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting violinist Itzhak Perlman in a single-night recital on February 19th at Benaroya Hall. Ticket information online at seattlesymphony.org.
46 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Forecast says expect showers through the day with an afternoon high of 49. A look at the plight of small liquor stores in Washington State in 25 minutes.
Eddie Wong has written Fresh Off the Boat. It's a memoir. He is a proprietor of Bauhaus, a street food restaurant in New York City, a Taiwanese street food restaurant in New York City. He explores cities, food, fashion, other cultures, as host of the Vice TV series Fresh Off the Boat, also in his writings in various places, and as well his memoir, Fresh Off the Boat. It's good to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Thanks for having me.
I've been enjoying watching the various Vice TV episodes I can see on the on the interwebs.
Nice. Which one's your favorite?
I was amused by the you're wandering through the streets of Taiwan and eating, coming across those weirdly shaped, what were they again? They were penis-shaped.
Oh, cakes. Yeah,
cakes.
Penis cakes.
Penis
yes,
cakes.
Yes, they were the penis
yes.
cakes. Yes.
And you were aghast. Though you did try to get people to eat them on camera.
I ate them. I actually have a box that I took home that I was going to give to my friends who own the Big Gay ice cream truck. And but en route, I got high one night and I ate the penis cakes myself, and they were delicious. They were filled with jelly. They were very good. Jelly, not syrup.
What? Describe the shoes you're wearing. Describe your outfit.
I got Jordan 5. They're the black Jordan 5s with the 3M tongue. I got these lounge pants, Micah Cohen lounge pants. They're like sweater pants, kind of, so you could wear them out. Then I got this vintage polo sweater with reindeers on them.
And then
my New Yorker hat, which is the logo of the New Yorker. My friends at Strada Custom Bikes made this hat.
So the reason I ask is because a good part of what you did growing up and have thought about is fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to start there.
Oh.
Why were sneakers important to you?
You know, it was like a status symbol. It really was. And also sneakers. But as a child, sneakers were important because it was your hopes and dreams in a box. You know, you watch those commercials with Michael Jordan and Mars Blackman. And I was never that great at sports. Just physically, I'm like 5'7". Right now I'm 5'7", like 180 pounds. And, you know, I'm just not built for sports. But I love sports. Sports was my first love. You know, I always wanted to be point guard of the Knicks. And I was one of those kids. And the book is very much about me having like these desires that don't match up with my physical body and my looks and things like that. And so sneakers, I always held them up as like my way out. Like if I got the Jordans, I could probably play better. I could probably jump higher. And as silly as it sounds, as a 10-year-old, that's how you feel about sneakers.
But then you followed up on that when you were in New York City and a dealer in sneakers.
Yeah, it's funny how the things you love don't manifest in the ways that you expect, but then later on in life, they do, you know, and so as much as I loved sneakers. I never became a professional basketball player, obviously. I never even got those Jordan 5s until I went to college. But in 2006, December of 2006, the fire red Jordan 5s were re-released, right? And this time with a black tongue, not a 3M tongue, and a 23 on the side. And I said to myself, I'm really into Obama, especially, you know, when he was talking about energy. And it was just off his DNC speech. And it was also, you know, he was one of the only senators to not want to go into the war in Iraq. And I was very, very inspired by him. And I thought he was such an interesting voice. And I saw a cover of Newsweek that said, could he be the next president? And I thought he could if people like me and people who believe in this jump in and we support this. And immediately that Christmas, I designed with my girlfriend at the time, Ning, who's in the book, a Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls jersey, just like his rookie jersey. We put it on a T-shirt. It said Chicago 08 and Obama 08 on the back. And it matched the fire red Jordan 5s. And so all the kids initially were buying them because they matched the sneakers. But then it became, you know, even the kids that were buying them at the time didn't know, who is this Obama guy? This is, I don't know. The shirt is just cool, but who is Obama? And then people started to catch on. And then it was very interesting because I made that shirt for the streetwear community, for downtown New York types. And then it started to grow into people who were into politics, you know, people at NYU, people at New School. Like, there were old people wearing the shirts, there were young people wearing the shirts, there were white people, there were black people, there were Latino people, there were Asians. And it just kind of like that T-shirt hit a critical mass. And this was even before Shepard Fairey had made his Obama shirts. I was known in streetwear and independent like fashion as the first dude to make Obama clothing.
What is streetwear? Why is streetwear so important in the culture of the late aughts and actually, you know, in the 90s too, in hip hop? Why is streetwear so important?
Great question. Streetwear to me was very important because when we were growing up, we all rocked Polo Sport, right? Or Nautica Competition. And there was, I think, Polo Outdoorsman. And those lines, and even you see with rugby now, a lot of kids in Harlem rock rugby and people in the street. When Ralph comes out with new lines, there's certain ones that the hood kind of gravitates towards, or kids like me that are into street style gravitate towards, but they always got discontinued. Like, we would all rock the shirts that said Polo spelled out, or they had the suicide ski guy, and Raekwon wore this Snow Beach jacket that said Snow Beach in the Can It All Be So Simple video, and we loved it. It was huge. And you know, like when Snoop wore Tommy Hilfiger onto Letterman, like that was a huge event. And I don't know if like regular news picked up on it, but like little magazines like Ego Trip or Word Up magazine or The Source, they would like write about this because we all followed that culture. And there's this culture now of people who, it started with the lowlifes. And these were guys in New York who would run 50, 60 deep into department stores and steal Polo off of racks. And yeah, and even in Orlando, we'd hear about these kids. We're like, yo, these are like the craziest dudes. Like, it's a fashion gang, you know? And we would collect Polo. I collected Polo Sport. I collected Nautica Competition. And it was sad, though, because he would always discontinue the lines. And it's almost like with Cristal. You know how Jay-Z stopped drinking Cristal because somebody came out and said they didn't want it associated with the urban market? We always felt that Ralph was discontinuing lines once it started popping in the hood. And streetwear was kind of like an answer back.
It was an answer back, right?
Yeah, it was definitely an answer back from the street saying, you know what? We know people who screen print now. We can make our own clothing, and we're going to make it represent us even more. And lines always talk about the ideal man. Who are you designing for? What is your ideal man? And when Ralph designed that Snow Beach jacket, he damn sure wasn't thinking, my ideal man is Raekwon, the Black Lex Luthor, which is what he called himself. And that's what was so special to me about streetwear, because we started seeing political messages, messages that were kind of cryptic that people who followed the culture would understand. And it was like you had to be a member to understand what that movement was about, and it was so special. But again, people, you know, after the recession hit, streetwear kind of faded away, but it's back, and the people that grew up with it and loved it, it means so much to us still, you know?
Well, membership is a critical part, because Eddie Wong, in writing Fresh Off the Boat and looking at your family, it's about belonging. Mm-hmm. It's about many things, but it's also about belonging.
Yes.
When did you know you were part of something bigger?
It was when I came to New York, and in the story, you know, the thing that's funny about my story is that I never felt a part of America at times. I think that everyone can relate. You know, everyone has those years, whether it's elementary school or middle school or high school. You face challenges at different times. Sometimes people have smooth sailing all the way till they're 26, and then boom, it's like the internet age midlife crisis is 26 years old now. But I just never fit in, and I couldn't be accepted by American, like, mainstream society. I wasn't even accepted in the Chinese community. And a lot of times my parents didn't accept me. My parents didn't want me to be the way I was. But I remember coming to New York when I came up to do a summer film course at Columbia. And I wanted to do a film demystifying the myth of the small Asian phallus. And it was a very Woody Allen-esque screenplay that I wrote. And it was about a foot-long hot dog vendor who was Asian, and all day he was kind of like, you know, neurotic about penis size, but all day he was selling footlong hot dogs, so that's all he could think about. I wrote that comedy, and it was really funny. But the professor said to me, you know, this film, he's like, this short film, it's really smart and it's really good, and he's like, I really want to encourage you to keep writing, but, you know, I don't think that there's a market for Asian film and Asian writing like this. You should probably change the characters to Jewish people. And I was like, look, I love Jewish people. I love Woody Allen, but this is my story. And I want to make films that relate to people like this. So it was funny because even in New York, I felt like at Columbia, I didn't fit in. But in my break time from classes and from the courses, I take the train downtown to Soho. And on Spring Street, there's this little store called Union. And if people who follow streetwear fashion know, there's a big brand called Supreme. And Union was owned by Marianne, who was the owner of Supreme. James owned Supreme. Marianne was his girlfriend. Marianne started Union with James, and James started Supreme, and they kind of worked on it together. They were two, like, kind of sister stores. Supreme is, like, the bigger brand now, and Union's gone. But at the time, I remember walking to Union, this little store, all dark wood, and hanging on the racks was, like, a shirt, black with, like, a emerald green print, and it said, Kaiser Soze. You know, Kaiser Soze Trucking. And I knew from Usual Suspects. And then there was shirts like in the Ramones logo, but it said Diplomats instead of Ramones. And it had all the members of the Diplomats. And it was kind of, that was the most iconic shirt to me. And it was a brand called Reason made it. And it was kind of saying, like, that generation of downtown New York, the Ramones were that group. You know, it's undeniable the Ramones were that group of that generation of downtown New York. But my generation of downtown New York, it's undisputed. It's the Diplomats, like Cameron, Jim Jones, Jewels, Freaky Zeke. Like, you play that song in any club or lounge in downtown New York, the DJ stops the music for a second, you'll hear the entire crowd reciting, like, on the Dipset anthem, put your two arms up, touchdown.
You know, you said something about hard times. And yeah. A lot of your book is about dealing with hard times, being treated, and then finding this membership. Would you do me a favor, if
sure.
you would? Would you read that chapter, that paragraph right there?
Yeah.
In between the red lines?
Sure. This is from page 240, the chapter They Don't Love Me. It says, My entire life, the single most interesting thing to me is race in America. How something so stupid as skin or eyes or stinky Chinese lunch has such an impact on a person's identity, their mental state, and the possibility of their happiness. It was race. It was race. It was race. Apologies to Frank Sinatra, but I've been called a chigger, a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a pawn, and a chink. That's life. I am obsessed with what it means to be Chinese. Think the idea of America is cool, but at the end of the day, wish the world had no lines.
But you took that idea after going to law school and doing some other things, and you looked back at your family, and you turned it into a restaurant.
Yeah.
Because you were exploring what it means to be Chinese in America, or to be an American, through Bauhaus? Bauhaus?
Definitely. You know, I told me and my brother's story of our kitchen, of our family, the decorations on the wall. The only decorations we had were old family photos showing three generations of Chinese people. It started off with my grandparents' photos in China, my parents' photos in Taiwan, and me and my brother's photos in D.C., in Orlando. And when you looked at us growing up, Americans, it was funny because me and my brothers had snapbacks and stencil shirt sweaters and hammer pants and all over prints. And it was funny. And to see these generations and to see how, you know, the civil war in China tore people apart. But then also there's a silver lining to everything, you know, and it's like we landed in America. And as painful it was as it was growing up, I found my own America. I carved out my own place and I shared my story. And it's just my dumb luck that people in New York related and appreciated it. And it's like it constantly – that's the story that constantly gives back to me. You know, like I get to write this book. I get to do the Vice show. I get to be on the radio and talk to you about it. And it's really beautiful because, you know, I don't I never allow myself to be blinded and feel like the world is post-racial or I'm done or I have nothing left to say. But, you know, I just feel like this is the beginning of the rest of my life, this book. And I feel like it is possible – to, for me, somebody to look like me, to be American and feel American and to be accepted here.
You said that you still don't go through a week where somebody doesn't roll down the window and say, go back to China.
All the time. All the time. It's like if I'm crossing the road, it's my own fault sometimes, I guess, if I'm texting and crossing the street and I get in the way of something. It happens all the time. I'm kind of like a space cadet like that. But no, the first thing people say is like, go back to China, or like on YouTube, people always call me a chigger. People always have something to say about that. And
it's mean when they're looking at your, like when we were talking about when they're looking at your Vice TV show?
Yeah.
And then the comments by the trolls?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I don't think people realize that, you know, when you're a person of color in a community that doesn't have much other color, you know, like in the subdivision I lived in Orlando, it was me and my brothers and Barry Larkin down the street, you know? And so pretty much it was, and there was one Dominican kid whose mom, his father died in the Air Force and his mother remarried, and it was just basically the three of us, Barry Larkin, me, and my friend, my Dominican friend Eazy-E. And, you know, even though I look Chinese and whatever, I was treated in many ways like the black sheep, the person of color in the neighborhood.
Except you did not accept the role of you did not take that role lying down.
No.
You were trouble in school. You were the bad kid at school, in part in response to that, right?
Yeah.
When I'm talking school, middle school, high school.
Yeah, no, it was reactionary.
Spam guns.
Yeah. No, my life went in three ways, and I think it's very common to people is, you know, if you're a person who's kind of outcast and not understood by people, your maybe first phase of evolution is to be reactionary. And I was reactionary, and I was a bad kid, and I was a troublemaker, and I would just kind of like want to be a contrarian. Then the second phase is getting in a lot of trouble and realizing, look, like you're not actually who you are. You're a reaction to people's understanding of who you are. And then it really set off a soul search to figure out, like, who is it that I am? Like, what is it that I like? Without like purging things out of my mind of the things other people have placed there, who is it that I am? And I think that's something that a lot of Americans go through, is the search for who you really are, what you really love, and to kind of like untangle the conditioning, you know, from the nurture element of your life.
Eddie Huang is proprietor of Bauhaus, Taiwanese street food restaurant in New York City. He's also host of a Vice TV series that's on the interwebs, if we don't have Vice TV on our cable channels, called Fresh Off the Boat. His writing has appeared in Grantland, Eater, New York Observer, and Fresh Off the Boat is also the title of his memoir. So who you are, in part, is the way you make those vows. Could you describe one of your favorite recipes and what goes into them? And you, I should say, you are as much a stickler for your food as any other Gordon Ramsay or Anthony Bourdain. You are harsh on some of the other people.
Yeah. No, I am a stickler for the food. And if anybody comes into the kitchen, they'll see. You know, like I am very, very picky about the way that we make the food items. I'm casual in my dress. I'm casual in my management style, but I'm not casual in the execution of the food. My favorite dish since I was a kid, you know, I always say my favorite thing is soup dumplings, you know, and it's because I don't make them right now at the restaurant. But as a kid growing up, I always loved red cooked pork, which is the recipe that we have for the Chairman Bao. And red cooked pork was always Mao's favorite dish. My father's side of the family is from Hunan, China, where Mao is from. And Hunan is famous for red cooked pork. It's braising pork, and it's a combination of ginger, soy sauce, rock candy, scallions, chilies, and soy, and rice wine. And that mixture creates, I like to call it almost Chinese barbecue, in the sense that you look for a redness to the pork, just like you look for a red ring on barbecue. Mm. You know, red cooked pork, you could tell if it's good and if it's done properly just from looking at the color of it. You know, and that's one thing I teach cooks a lot at Bauhaus is to cook with sight. You know, like, you know, a lot of people like to taste and a lot of people like to smell, but I also like to teach them to cook with sight, you know. We have so many orders every day that you have to use your eyes just as much as your nose and your mouth, you know?
It's interesting about that since you also said you called it Bauhaus in homage to Bauhaus.
Yeah.
The architectural of clean lines and simplicity.
Definitely. Definitely. Like, and also sustainability, you know? And they were very sustainable and efficient. And all their design was efficient and it was good for industrial spaces. And I really liked the Bauhaus movement. I thought it was very, very interesting. And I think it still lives. And I think the Bauhaus movement still very much dominates a lot of the strategy and philosophy of architecture in, say, you know, Portland or New York or Brooklyn. Like a lot of people, you still see that those thoughts permeating the architecture of our time.
You're going to be at Town Hall with Gio?
Yeah.
From Blue Scholars?
Yep. Love Gio. Love Blue Scholars, and Seattle's a really fun place, so I'm really happy to be here with
you. Any food places that you – have you come here enough to know some food places? Or are you
I've only
you?
Been here one time in 2005 when I actually wanted to go to UW because I wanted to go to law school there. I thought Seattle was a cool city, and I was walking around. I didn't really know anyone, but I stumbled upon I know it's like a goofy pick, but I thought Pierogi was so cool because I'd never seen anything. Like, I'd never had a Pierogi in my life. So, I mean, I don't know if people here take it for granted, but I thought Pierogi was pretty cool. Like, I'm really into Eastern European food, you know?
Yeah.
Jewish food, Eastern European food. Like, Pierogi was kind of interesting to me. Yeah. It's just different.
I saw a Bourdain yesterday called The Layover, and he was in Seattle, and he went to a place I'd never heard of in Rainier that was a Vietnamese place that was making Vietnamese food. I can't even remember the name of it now. I got to remember
the
name.
Oh, wow. What dishes were they making?
They made this shredded greens with a little bit of beef that they had sautéed on top of it, so it was a salad. And then on top of that, they put green papaya.
Oh, nice, like a beef salad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was real nice. I'd never seen it before.
Yeah, no, Vietnamese food, very underrepresented, very underrated. You know, I love Vietnamese food. You know, a few of the foods that I hope that become more represented in America is definitely Vietnamese. Korean food is probably the most, it's the best, it's the most undefeated, I think, winter food. When I'm sick in the winter, like, all I eat is Korean food. And Taiwanese food. Taiwanese food is very, very funky. And I wrote an article for Bon Appetit lately about the element of funk in Taiwanese food.
What is it?
It distinguishes it from things. It's like, obviously, the most prominent example is stinky tofu, which is tofu cured in rotten cabbage. But also the use of preserved bamboo, dried shrimp, dried baby fish, you know, the offal intestines, they all lend a bit of funk to things. And then the, like, very prominent use of oysters. We love to use oysters and shellfish and all parts of the pig. So there's numerous ways that in Taiwanese food you introduce that element of funk or stink, which is kind of what is appealing about cheese. And it's kind of permeates all of Taiwanese cuisine, is that kind of stinkiness. Which I think is interesting.
It is interesting because mm-hmm. it's about, I mean, where did that come from? But people who were poor having to use
preservation.
Yeah. What's next for you as a restaurant owner?
You know, I'm really interested in the idea. Number one, I want to make healthier food, right? I love pork belly, and pork belly will always be on the menu. We'll always have the pork belly. We'll always have the fried chicken. But there are so many other dishes in the Taiwanese and Chinese canon that are things you can eat every day and make a meal out of, you know? And I do really feel like, why hasn't someone done a Taiwanese or Chinese home-style restaurant that kind of plays on that idea of meat and three? Because that's how you eat at home, too. One protein dish, three vegetables, and then a starch, you know? And so we want to do Bauhaus going forward with – we're going to always have Baos. We're always going to do the best Baos, in my opinion. But we want to open them in different neighborhoods – localize the dishes a little bit and introduce more things that are on rice with multiple vegetables and leaner proteins. But things like Hainan chicken. Love Hainan chicken. I love lion's head meatballs. I want to do like the stewed peppers and bamboo with woodier fungus. There's just so many dishes I grew up eating that I want to share with people, and I love that kind of meat and three setup.
Eddie Huang is author of Fresh Off the Boat. It's his memoir. It's also his TV show on Vice TV, and there's a lot of episodes. You should check them out. He runs Bauhaus in New York City, and I hope you find some good places when you're wandering here today.
Definitely. Thanks, man.
I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
He's going to be at Town Hall tonight with Gio at 7:30. Rainier Barbecue. Rainier Barbecue? Is that what it's called that Bourdain mentioned? All right. Rainier Barbecue. Did you see that, Andy? All right. Rainier Barbecue. We'll have to check it out.
Cool.
This is Weekday.
Thank you.
Some small liquor stores here in Washington State are having a tough time. We'll find out what's going on with that in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
50 miles south of Mexico City, there's a cave, the Cueva del Diablo.
There's a lot of Mexican long-nosed bats over here.
It's an important roost for a rare species of bat.
They're mating. You can tell. Just look at pairs forming, and a male is grabbing a female from behind. There's one there.
Inside the Devil's Cave with Mexico's Batman, next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine, delivering primary and specialty care to patients at Harborview Medical Center, UW Medical Center, Northwest Hospital, Valley Medical Center, 9 UW Neighborhood Clinics, and Airlift Northwest. More information at uwmedicine.org.
It's 9:46. The dispute between China and Japan over some disputed islands seems to be escalating. We'll see where that's at in 20 minutes.
Yeah, Rainier Barbecue. If you didn't get a chance to see the layover episode that Anthony Bourdain, they aired last night, it's his last one. It was on the Travel Channel. It'll be online. The layover, he was in Seattle. It was pretty fun. Many places I've never been to. It just shows you how little we know about the places we live in. But Rainier Barbecue looked like a pretty great place. We'll have to find out more. And if you folks know about it, send us an email about it. But let's turn to liquor store owners. Now, 7 months ago after the state, 7 months after the state got out of the liquor business, some of the entrepreneurs who stepped in are finding it hard to compete. Private bidders collectively paid $30 million to own and operate former state liquor stores, and now many are finding that the private liquor market favors the big box stores like Safeway and Costco, which what was warned when that measure was passed. And they're hoping the state legislature can step in to help level the playing field. David Cho is director of the Washington State Liquor Association. He's owner of Tacoma's Westgate Liquor and Wine. David Cho, thanks for talking to us.
Hi, thank you for having me on. How are you?
It's good to talk. Now, tell me something. Didn't we expect this to happen? This is what people were saying. The big box stores were going to be able to corner the market.
Sure. There was a talk that Costco would sell goods a little cheaper, which they are, because they can buy their 10,000 cases at a time. That's fine. Safeways, Albertsons, Walmarts, they could also buy in bulk so they can sell their goods a little cheaper, so that's fine. However, there are a number of things that I don't think the average person knows happened and transpired that is creating a distinct disadvantage for us as retailers.
And what are those?
Okay, so number one, for example, if I sell to a retail customer that comes in, I got to charge them 17%, which I send to the liquor board. If a restaurant and bar comes in, their wholesale transaction, I still have to charge them 17%. That was not communicated to us when we took over all these stores.
But doesn't everybody have to? Doesn't Costco have to pay that too? For example,
Costco has to pay that 17%. Correct. However, the distributors do not. So they're at a distinct advantage. They sell to restaurants, and they're actually setting up express stores without the 17%.
How can they do that?
Because they're considered distributors and not retailers.
So, who buys from an express store? Wholesalers? I mean, retailers?
No, the retailers cannot. Bars and restaurants do. So basically, bars and restaurants was about 20 to 30% of the actual liquor sale totals. That business is totally gone.
I see. So you're sort of cut out of that business as a small liquor store.
You know, it's really interesting because when this first thing started, you know, when everything started, yes, we can sell to Class H's. Yes, they're considered wholesale. We even had to get a wholesale license from the federal government. When they come in, we have to charge them wholesale taxes. However, we still have to charge them 17%, which we do for the average mom and pop that walks in here. So that business is totally gone. That's about over $300 million.
Now, you know, we're hearing numbers for these folks who bought into these liquor stores of a failure rate of 30 to 50%.
That's correct.
Is that what you're hearing as director of the Washington Liquor Store Association?
Absolutely. I don't have hard numbers. When you say failures, it's hard to say failures because a lot of them didn't even open.
Oh.
And that's a very interesting story. That's another part of the puzzle that is that a lot of the listeners don't know. When each of us won our auctions, and the average auction was about $300,000, we were mandated to sign immediately with our landlord. Every landlord within the one-mile radius also knew that we had to sign immediately. The rates that we all got were sky high. So, disadvantage. We are all choking under these high rents. Now, if you could imagine, every liquor store, when it was operating as a monopoly, had to have huge space in the back for their inventory. That makes sense. We are no longer a monopoly. We are retailers, and we are going to operate small. We had this huge space that we had to take or be kicked out and have no store. And in fact, there are a lot of people that won these auctions, paid $500,000, $300,000. When they went to negotiate with the landlord said, I can't sell you, I can't rent you a space because the Safeway next door or the Fred Meyer's next door won't let me. Those individuals, out.
So David Cho, let me ask you, and I don't mean to be rude, but is this a buggy whip situation? I mean, are liquor stores, the small liquor stores, just not part of the future because of the fact that I can go into, you know, Whole Foods has a place to buy liquor, and all sorts of places are now selling me liquor. Is it just not possible for liquor stores to really be in business the way they were?
Well, if that's the case, then liquor stores, small liquor stores, would be dead everywhere, and California, New Jersey, Georgia, everywhere. That would be the natural progression of the market. However, that's not the case. In Washington, the only state where we have to pay 17% as a license fee to the state. Now, the problem is that Walmarts and the Albertsons that you talk about, you pick up maybe 200 different brands of liquor. My store and a lot of other stores have about 2,500. So where are you going to go to buy your ginger vodka? You can't, if we close. Where are you going to go to buy your Blue Curacao or your Absolute that's currant flavored? You can't. So, unfortunately, what's happening is we are a dying breed. We are all small business owners in Washington, and we are being shut out by out-of-state conglomerates.
How are the conglomerates part of that?
Well, the conglomerates I'm talking about, as I would reference the Walmarts and the Safeway.
I see.
But you know, they have a distinct advantage, and you know, that's fine. They're able to buy 10,000 cases at a time. You know, you and I know that that's an advantage, and they can charge cheaper prices.
Right.
However, us store owners, we wanted to start a co-op. That was it's almost impossible to start a co-op. The laws make it so.
So, David Cho, that would be one way to compete, change the law to allow small owners to band together to buy in bulk. What other changes would you like to see?
Well, we're also trying to have the Class H 17% removed. That's also being there's a bill outstanding right now. So, I mean, I see all these comments from readers. They say, oh, these guys are just complaining, they're just crying. But when we got into this, we knew that we had to pay 70%. We knew we had to compete with Costco and Safeways, and we all had our business model. However, there's so many other items that we did not know would exist. For example, did you know that if I buy 10 cases of Absolut, let's say, my price per bottle is higher than a restaurant next door that gets delivered one bottle? Why is that? I don't know. You tell me. The distributors have the distinct ability to charge whatever they want.
So you feel that there's a
discrimination, absolutely. Discrimination.
Deliberate.
It's out there. It's they publicly admitted it, that they can charge whatever they want. They have the power to do. So when I read this thing, it said distributors can charge based on economic fundamentals. Economic fundamentals, fine. 10,000 cases to Costco, yeah, please, you know, you could sell cheaper. You save gas, you know, you save manpower. But the restaurant next door, you're going to sell it cheaper than to me, and I got to charge 17% to the liquor board, and then I got to put my small margin on that.
Let me ask you something, one last quick question on that. If you got rid of the 70% fee, part of the way this was sold to the public was that, you know, money would go into the system, that 70% fee is part of that. Would you pick up the money somewhere else? Would you propose some tax increase somewhere else that affects everyone?
You're asking me for political questions of how to substitute my revenue. I'm not saying that we should pay 17%. I mean, that 17% should be removed. I'm saying, number one, that if I sell to bars and restaurants, Class H customers who don't consume the product but who in turn resell it, I shouldn't have to pay the 17%.
All right. I got you.
That's what I'm saying.
I get you.
So we're not crying over what we knew was going to happen. We're crying because common business practice dictates that if I buy larger quantities than the guy next door, I should get a cheaper price, the way that Costco and Safeway do, but I do not. So I'm right in the middle.
Right in the middle. All right. Well, we'll hear follow it. We'll see what the legislature says about some of these ideas. David Cho is director of the Washington State Liquor Association, owner of Tacoma's Westgate Liquor and Wine. Some of the smaller liquor store owners are struggling to stay in business. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This is Weekday. And now, let's get a hike from Michael Fagan. He joins us every Tuesday to suggest a hike to match the week's weather forecast. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Steve.
How's the weather look?
Well, we're right in a little temporary rain shadow right now in the greater Seattle area. But basically, for today through Thursday, we're looking at rain on and off. Next wave of moisture moving in will be later tonight and into Wednesday. And if you're looking for the best days for the views, Friday through Sunday, we get a ridge of high pressure building for some dry weather. So the hike we have for this week, and it is good rain or shine because it's close in and you get some exercise. Rattlesnake Mountain, west side approach, just outside of North Bend. If you hike in about 4 miles, you get some nice views from Grand Prospect. And you don't need any snowshoes. You'll run into some hard-packed snow the last mile, but some good hiking boots will be fine. You might want to use some yak tracks coming down. We have a picture of the yak tracks to help you with your traction on the way down. And again, another highlight, it's, you know, the mileage isn't too bad. It's about 4 miles one way, 2,000-foot gain to get to this viewpoint. And if you do want to go to Rattlesnake Mountain, that's a little bit over another half mile, but you'll need snowshoes for that part. And if you want to get a hike in this afternoon in between the heavy rain, you can do it because, again, it's close in. If you really want a good workout, you could do two cars. Park one car at Rattlesnake Mountain, one at the west end, and you hike the entire length of Rattlesnake Mountain. You'll need snowshoes for that, and that's about 11 miles round trip. So that's a bit of a workout, but a fun trip.
That's a fun trip. Hey, by the way, February 5th, as you mentioned, National Weather Person's Day, commemorating the birth of John Jeffries in 1744, America's first weather observer. So you have a day all your own.
Yeah, so hug a weather person today. All hugs and lunches are welcome. How's that?
That's very good. Michael Fagan's weather and hike blog is hikewashington.net. He gives us a Tuesday forecast and a hike to match the weather. And he's got links to that Rattlesnake Mountain hike at hikewashington.net. I appreciate that. I hope to get out. I hope to talk to you again next week, sir.
Yeah, and need a Discover Pass and his Green Trails Map 205S. So talk to you next week.
All right, good. And also, by the way, there's a Washington Ski Touring Club meeting February 7th at REI downtown. Are you going to go to that?
Absolutely. It's first Thursday of the month, and free meetings, and this one will be very interesting. Slideshow on the winter ecology at Snoqualmie Pass. They have a Forest Service biologist doing the presentation. Starts at 7 p.m. at the downtown REI in Seattle, and we have a link to that on the blog today, so should be fun.
All right, hikewashington.net. Check it out. Also, KOW.org to get there. Thank you, Michael.
You bet.
That is not in the shower. That's the sound of Goldmeyer Hot Springs, just past North Bend, along the Middle Fork with Snoqualmie. And what you're hearing is the source of the hot springs flowing into a stone cave at about 118 degrees. Weekday listener Ben sent that to us. He listens to Weekday in an off-the-grid cabin in the mountains. A reminder that wherever you are, there are interesting sounds to hear, record, and share at weekday@kuow.org with Sound of the Day in the subject line. Stick around.
It's 47 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Forecast says expect showers today with a high of 49.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting La Bohème, the camaraderie, struggle, and passions of young lovers in Paris, conveyed by Puccini's sweeping score. La Bohème plays February 23rd through March 10th at McCaw Hall. Details at seattleopera.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.